Welcome to the latest episode of Lisa and Phil Ruin the Movies with me, your hostess, Lisa Schmeiser, and my co-host, Philip Michaels.
Hi, I'm Philip Michaels, the host of Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies.
One of those. I'll let you have it.
My version is the better version, I think.
Is it canon?
Yes. Yes, you're in the version that you're talking about, Lisa and Phil Ruin the Movies.
Crisis on Infinite Podcasts.
That takes place on Earth 2.
Crisis on Infinite Podcast.
Yes, exactly.
There should be a crossover.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Okay, if you'll excuse me, I have to scurry off to the Incomparable Slack and pitch this now. Mm-hmm. I think everyone will love it.
The Phil on Earth 2 is charming.
I know. Why do you think I said it's the Phil on Earth 2? So we are here to talk about some of the trailers that have come out this summer and to discuss movie musicals.
Yeah, the genesis of this, the origin story, if you will.
Of the Earth One podcast.
Because all movies start with an origin story that nowadays. Mm-hmm. You took our daughter to see a movie today while I was watching the world's most boring European Cup final. Mm-hmm. You saw...
I took our daughter to see The Secret Life of Pets.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which we can talk about at the end when we talk about other movies. But there are trailers, so many trailers, in fact, that our daughter turned to you and said... Is the movie ever starting?
Yes.
And you said, quiet, mommy's moneymaker is on.
No, it was after trailer number 5, and that's when I said, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I just don't know. But yeah, there were a boatload of trailers. I saw one for a Trolls movie coming out.
Right.
Which looks preemptively dreadful.
Is this based on the Trolls dolls?
Yes, it is. Mm. And yeah, there's musical numbers involved too, because it's got Anna Kendrick and Justin Timberlake as the leads. Thereby guaranteeing I'll never watch it because Justin Timberlake is still on my list.
He's on your list, yeah.
After the Super Bowl, he left Janet Jackson a twist in the wind and he's never apologized. So I hold a grudge.
Yeah, you do.
So there's that. There was also a trailer for a movie which I forgot to look up for this podcast. And yeah, now is when I should pitch. By the way, sponsor the podcast. It's quality content.
Yeah. A lot of preparation went into this. You went to see a movie and sort of remember some stuff, and that's our prep.
There was the Pete's Dragon trailer.
Yeah, which we've already discussed on an earlier episode.
We did discuss an earlier, and our daughter was not thrilled by it. She was actually kind of scared and confused. Mm. So
did she like the dragon?
No.
Oh.
Because the dragon is terrifying. It's... You want to know, like, we were 5 or 6 when we saw that movie, or however old we were.
And seven.
And Mickey Rooney was the most terrifying thing in the movie.
Yeah.
Because Elliot is this goofy-looking Don Bluth mother who you know, like, makes the funny faces and the funny noises. And now, instead, you've got, like, an extra from the Game of Thrones who has somehow wandered into a Disney movie and, like, looks legitimately menacing and growls and doesn't speak or something. Why love you too? And our 5-year-old daughter was terrified of it. So there's that.
Pete's Dragon.
Mm-hmm. There was a live-action movie about a young lady from Liberia who becomes a chess champion, and I did not catch the name of the movie because I was crying so hard from the inspirational trailer.
Oh, wow.
I wish I were making that up, but I'm not. But, like, Lupita Nyong'o comes on screen and, like, radiates serene, loving wisdom, and I was just a goner, like, just tears streaming down the face, and children playing chess, and Civil War happening in the background, and it's coming out in November, and I'm going to go see it and cry all the way through it, too, I think. Okay. And among the other trailers they had were one for a Disney movie I'm very excited to take Trixie to, called Moana.
Yes, and I saw this trailer as well.
It's a teaser, really, because it's 90 seconds long.
It's a very short trailer. Yeah. And it basically looks
you have
like
the Rock monologuing about the origin story of the Polynesian god Maui.
Yes. It basically very heavy Pacific Islander, very heavy Hawaiian legends, and using that as the leaping off point for a story of indeterminate plotting.
And then over the end of the trailer, Lin-Manuel Miranda sings vaguely affirmational things about how we're all going to be getting better in every day, every way.
Yeah.
So there's that.
Yeah. And you know, Disney, this is the kind of movie Disney does well.
Well, to be honest, when I looked at the aesthetics, I thought, okay, this is kind of a mix of the Lilo and Stitch aesthetic crossed with almost The Incredibles. Just the way that the look and the feel of it all comes together.
It had more of a Wreck-It Ralph look to me, actually.
That's a good point.
The There's really two, like you say, animation styles, and mm-hmm. the first bit when it's the Rock recounting the legend of Maui mm-hmm. really does have that Lilo and Stitch very highly yeah. stylized feel. But then they cut to Maui himself, who is Rock, Dwayne Johnson, does the Rock's the people's eyebrow,
yeah,
which I think is kind of a cheap laugh.
It's a cheap pop, as they would say in the wrestling business.
Mm-hmm. So, but that very, very reminiscent of Wreck-It Ralph. And mm. We didn't look it up, but I would imagine it's much the same crew that worked on that movie.
I know one of the writers on Moana, and she's just gone to work on Wreck-It Ralph too. So I'm pretty sure.
So this is not the Pixar mm-hmm. arm of Disney Animation. No, this is the Disney arm of Disney Animation. Right. Yeah. So yeah, it looks good. They do those stories well.
Well, out of all the trailers I saw, because there was that one, there's the Dreadful Trolls trailer that I can remember. There was People Play Chess and Make Me Cry.
Mm-hmm. Alan Tudyk does a voice in this.
Of course, Alan Tudyk does a voice in that.
So even more.
And then the last trailer that I can remember us watching is for the latest Ice Age sequel. And at that point, my eyes rolled back so far in my head that I lost consciousness because mm-hmm. they're like, oh, a comet is coming and we're facing extinction. But I thought cynically to myself, you can't have animals go extinct in a children's franchise. That doesn't work out. And needless to say, over the course of the trailer, they're like, and here's how it's going to work out for the best. Mm-hmm. And so it is my sincerest hope that what happens with this latest installment of Ice Age is when it comes out, a bunch of paleontology students get really stoned and go see it and laugh hysterically all the way through it.
Sure.
Like, I sort of feel like that's the best possible scenario.
But yeah, the only thing with the Moana trailer mm-hmm. that didn't work for me was the
singing at the end.
The singing was a little...
It's a little...
It's a little bit, you are the best possible you, and you're going to challenge things.
So way back in the early 1990s.
Think back, children.
Wait, well, you may not even have been alive then, some of you who are listening to this, and I don't want to know if that's the case.
Yeah.
There once was a magazine.
There were only four television networks.
No, there once was a magazine called Glamour. It may still
George W. Bush's father was president.
It may still be out, but it was edited by a...
When we wanted to play video games, we had to go to arcades.
Fairly impressive editor named Ruth Whitney, and she instituted
magazines.
A couple changes to the magazines that were pretty impressive and long-lasting. And the first was that she insisted that actresses always be known as actors, under the idea that you don't feminize professions. And then...
At the risk of getting punched in the nose again.
I didn't punch you in the nose. I smacked my hand over your mouth so you could let me finish a sentence.
My high school drama teacher didn't like the term actress because she called it a show busy Hollywood term.
Yeah. See, we know her. But the other thing she did is she had a great movie critic who once wrote a piece in, I want to say it was the fall of 1991, about the phenomenon called the vaguely uplifting ballad. And in the piece that I read in Glamour billions of years ago, it was about the dumb song associated with Thelma and Louise, where Glenn Frey sings it.
That is the worst thing about Thelma and Louise. Yes. By far the worst thing.
It's a movie about two women who commit suicide. And I mean, there's stuff that happens before they do, but that is the end game. And long story short.
Also, the other bad thing about Thelma and Louise, a movie which I like.
Yeah.
It's a very good movie. And this comes from the Kermode and Mayo podcast when they had mm-hmm. Ridley Scott on to talk about The Martian. Mm-hmm. And they say, well, this movie is very funny and you're really not known for your comedies. Mm-hmm. And there's this pause and Ridley Scott says, Thelma and Louise was a comedy. And everyone just listening like, was, no.
Have you seen the end of that movie?
No, Ridley. Yeah. It's not. Anyhow. So,
but
yeah, terrible song by Glenn.
So, Frey. And this writer, whose name has been lost in the mist of history because I have never bothered to go to a library and find that issue and read it again, mm-hmm. which just goes to show bylines don't matter for, has permanently screwed into my brain the concept of the vaguely uplifting ballad. And Moana has this going on at the end where it's a vaguely uplifting ballad. And so you do feel good at the end of watching those 90 seconds because you're like, oh, it's going to be an epic adventure. And at the end of it, there'll be better people. And oh, you know, suffering is never pointless because it makes you a more awesome person. And that's exactly what it's designed to do. Like that teaser was grown in a lab because it is just so precisely engineered.
Yep. Mm-hmm. It has the nod to pop culture with the people's eyebrow. And,
yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah. So, mm-hmm. looks good.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to a full-length trailer. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So that was it, basically. And after watching the interminable reel of trailers, we watched the movie, and it was okay.
And so when you were showing me the Moana trailer, the next thing that popped up...
was a trailer for something called Sing.
Something called Sing. You have probably seen this. It has the pig in the spandex.
Yeah.
And it's
with Nick Kroll doing the voice
Nick
of the
Kroll
pig
is
in
the voice.
Spandex.
He's doing his German voice.
Yeah.
And this is a holiday release.
Yeah.
So plan accordingly. Or you could just watch the 5-minute trailer.
It is epic.
Which guarantees to have all of the
every
laughs.
Every one of the plot points.
Every one of the plot points and laughs and things that you'd want to see in the movie. It also is going to suffer because it's coming out a good, I'm doing math in my head now, 8 months after Zootopia.
Yeah.
So, and it is Zootopia. There's a guy who
owns... Zootopia goes to American Idol.
Yeah, there's a guy who owns his theater. He's a koala bear. His theater is failing.
That's what I saw.
And so he decides to have an American Idol type thing where people are going to get to live their dreams. And we get to see every animal in creation.
And they all have depressing lives.
Singing a song. Yeah.
And then there's a whole sequence with all sorts of gimmicks, like a snail singing about speed. Mm-hmm. And it just had the feel. I was like, is this what they made to convince people to invest in this movie? Because this has the feel of it'll be more of this if you just give us the money. Please.
Yeah.
We want to have bunnies that sing the Baby Got Back song because that will be absolutely hilarious. So, I found Sing profoundly depressing for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. First of all, I thought this way as a kid too, so rest assured this is not merely an adult being a jerk about things. I was presumably a child being a jerk about things. I have always wondered how the exigencies of daily life work when you have animals that act like people.
Yeah.
Like...
then you wouldn't have enjoyed Zootopia.
No. Actually, the trailers kind of drove me bonkers because I just kept wondering why none of the animals ate each other. I wondered about...
Well, that's the central thesis of the movie.
I wondered about population control. I wondered how species without thumbs were wearing clothes with buttons. I wondered about how they cook things. This also drove me nuts in the Secret Life of Pets today, too, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Because the movie takes place over the course of just one day. And I was like, no, that's kind of nonsense. But this Sing drives me bonkers because you see grocery stores and pigs walking around their little rear trotters as they get groceries. And for whatever reason, that just bugs me immensely. Like, do they shriek and faint when they get to the butcher section?
Is that Richard Scarry book,
the big book of little words or whatever it was. Yeah.
Is actually a scene when they are at the butcher shop and it is the pig family and there's bacon in the display case and the pigs are all, look at the bacon. Yeah. We should get that tonight. We're cannibals.
Yeah, no, so it's always bugged me. Like, again, you have species with no thumbs. How do they put on clothes? Or...
yes, that is the most troubling thing about the pigs walking around the butcher store.
Well, my question is, like, who invented electricity in this world? And
obviously, or the electric eels. Question solved. mystery fulfilled.
How did they get it out of the water? Like, who is the Nikola Tesla of the lower chordates?
Obviously, a salamander, because they live in both water and land.
So there's an uber class of amphibian scientists, is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
I actually buy that explanation. Yeah. but there's a lot of this. Cars, like combustible engines. There's just so much about this that's so confusing. And anthropomorphizing animals for all the wrong reasons. Mm-hmm. And
on Peppa Pig.
I am pretty... well, oh, Peppa Pig...
The mammals are the ones who have lives and jobs.
Their pets are all birds and reptiles and fish. That I find that fascinating that they drew the line there.
Yeah, kind of racist.
Species, do you mean?
No, racist. Oh, the mammals are the smart ones, but the reptiles, pets.
Well, you can't really quantify intelligence in other species. You can try, because octopi are really quite smart. But, you know, I remember when I was reading Susan Casey's book, The Devil's Teeth, which is about great white sharks off the Farallon Islands, a scant 25 miles to the west of us.
Mm-hmm.
She interviews several people who are like, yeah, I can swear the great white sharks are very smart. It's just a very alien type of intelligence. And we're never going to have like the fish to human translator system that tells you what the great white shark is thinking. So I buy the idea of multiple species being smart. I'm still just really baffled about how animals with trotters put on things that zip and button. I'm sorry. Ever since I was a child, that has bothered me.
Well, I think the act of going to the cinema involves a certain amount of
suspension of disbelief. It
Lisa, does, yeah. As we go into the dream factory that is the Hollywood motion picture. Yeah. Matthew McConaughey is the voice of the koala bear, by the way, thus ending the
reign of Australia. I feel that's just so wrong. I feel like an Australian should do that. Why don't they have an Australian actor?
Why didn't they get Hugh Jackman?
Yeah.
He likes to sing.
He does.
He's a showman.
Yeah. And he could promote the heck out of this movie. Like, Hugh Jackman is your number one go-to for promoting movies.
Yeah, he promoted the heck out of Pan, and that was not a good motion picture.
Bless his heart. Yeah. And now I'm just depressed about Hugh Jackman's career.
Captain Bringdown.
Well, because you look at the movies he's made, and you're like, oh.
Yeah, no.
So...
And it animation is a funny business because you're torn between trying to create something new, and trying to do something that will make you lot. There's the cruel stench of commerce.
So here's the thing: is Finding Nemo works for me because it's fish being fish,
right?
Always and
the fish aren't wearing pants.
Yeah, exactly. And even when they get out of the aquarium, they don't have opposable thumbs, and there's no Mission Impossible music that plays while
they're not hailing a cab. They're not.
Yeah, no, none of that. And that's why it works for me. That's why I like Finding Nemo so much. If we ever get to see Finding Dory, or as my daughter calls it, Finding Dorothy, because she's under the impression the fish's name is Dorothy.
Because that's Elmo's fish's name on Sesame Street.
I think so.
All fish are named Dorothy.
Although, as we walked to the theater today, she gave me the entire plot of Finding Dory, so evidently her school has no spoiler policy. And
I don't have interest in seeing it. And I enjoyed Finding Nemo.
I don't care enough about Dory to find out what the backstory is, to be honest with you.
I generally do not like the Pixar sequels.
I'm trying to think if there's a sequel they've made that I've watched and enjoyed.
Did you like the Toy Story sequels?
I've never seen any of the Toy Story movies.
Okay.
To be honest, do you want to know how the Toy Story has infiltrated our household? Is we're usually over at a friend's house for a barbecue, and around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, all of the adults want to crack open the 10th bottle of wine.
Yeah.
And so, before you judge, know that there's a lot of adults. And then somebody throws Toy Story onto a TV and 14 children go in to watch. And that is literally my only exposure to Toy Story is peeking my head in to see if they're still fixed on the screen.
Right. And they are.
So there's been what, three of them, I think?
There's been three. There's a fourth one coming up. Even though the third one kind of seemed like it put a nice bow on the whole.
Yeah, because I thought the third one was Andy grew up and gave his toys to Bonnie.
Yes.
Because we do have the Toy Story shorts at home. And Trix has watched those with me. And I know that now all of the toys belong to a little girl named Bonnie. So
yeah.
I would actually be kind of excited, though, if Toy Story 4 centers around Bonnie and her interior life, because it'd be nice to see that.
So with the idea that, you know, people get to explore the worlds they want to explore, there's something about the Pixar sequels, and this is colored entirely by Cars 2.
Yeah.
Cars, one of the worst original Pixar movies.
Yeah.
And also
bothered me because I just kept wondering, how do they fuel up? Who builds them? How do they... No, seriously. How do they reproduce?
Lisa, they're built by God. They're reproduced at a factory. It's very simple if you sit down and think about it.
That whole world drove me bonkers.
Anyhow, I didn't care for Cars. No. And Cars 2 came out, and that's... And the whole thing has this feel that there's a knock at the Pixar door every... There you go. Sound effects. Yeah. Foley artist. There's a knock at the Pixar door and someone opens it and goes, hey, Mickey, what are you doing here? Oh, hi. I just came by for my package. Oh, look, looks a little light this month. Oh, I hope it's not light next month.
So does the Foley artist need to get the salary for breaking bones now?
Listen, you sons of bitches.
Oh my God!
We put a lot of money into you jerks. quit doing the Wall-E crap and start churning out some money makers. Mm-hmm. Mickey's got a condo on the Riviera he's got to pay for. Ah!
That is horrifying.
Yeah.
Also,
I think Goofy would be the enforcer.
No, because Goofy's incompetent.
Yeah, but then because that way it would be more painful because he doesn't know which bones to break.
No, I think what
Mickey said to break your knees. My arm, Goofy.
Like it's Mickey and Donald is the crazy bad cop and Mickey is the good cop. And so while Donald is busy foaming at the mouth and threatening to kill your children, Mickey's all, we can be reasonable about this. Just I'm bumping up the VIG by 10%. You know?
Look, I can't hold him back any longer.
So Donald Duck and people are terrified.
Donald Duck voice if we're waiting for that.
And people are terrified of a pantsless duck, and that's just how it works.
Oh man, sure. Yeah. Who wouldn't be?
Terrified of a pantsless duck.
Mm-hmm. Who learned his trade in the Navy.
Yeah, that's
so you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking back to the Pixar movies I've liked the most haven't had sequels yet. Because I'm one of the few who really likes Ratatouille.
Ratatouille is great. That is my favorite Pixar movie. Incredibles will soon have a sequel.
So here's the thing is I will take your point on Cars 2. Yeah. I have to remain agnostic on the Toy Stories because, again, I only have any fluency in the shorts.
Monsters U.
Oh, God, that's right. They made a bunch of those. So. But it seems to me that maybe Pixar threads a needle where they have some movies they make purely for the love of experimentation that they know are not going to be sequel worthy. And then there are other movies that they do perpetuate a franchise in because it gives them the financial and creative freedom to make weird stuff like Wall-E and Ratatouille.
Mm-hmm.
For example, and what I'm also going to point out is The Incredibles is a pretty natural fit for sequels because it does.
That one actually would work as a sequel.
Because
it's a comic book movie. Because
you see The Incredibles kids grow up, for example. And
there's a lot you can do with The Incredibles that would were you to make a second movie as they are, it would not clearly be a cash grab.
Yeah, no, because again, it's a genre.
As Cars 2 was.
It's a genre movie that works well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you do want to buy into the whole capitalist Mickey shakes you down and breaks your kneecap thing.
And I do.
Then, you know, making more than one Cars movie makes a lot of sense because it allows them to strengthen the amusement park.
Yep.
Offerings because Cars is a really strong amusement park presence. We saw that when we were at Disney in March.
Mm-hmm.
And more critically, it allows Disney and Pixar to build out their base among little boys because they've locked down the branding channel for girls from birth on.
Yeah.
But, I mean, let's face it, one of the reasons they acquired Marvel and the Star Wars properties was because they wanted to make sure they could lock down little boys as consumers too.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure
that... I feel that the Muppets are getting short shrift in this global conglomerate.
Given what they did with the Muppet Show last fall, is it really so bad that they're ignoring the Muppets right now?
No, that's true.
Yeah.
Discussed on another podcast.
Yeah. So, you know, leave the Muppets alone for a while, I say.
Okay. Sure.
But with regard to the Pixar sequels, yeah, some of them do feel like, oh, they're franchise builders. But if you want to look at it from a more pragmatic perspective, building out the franchises buys you space and capital to say, we're going to make a movie about a robot that picks up humanity's trash, or we're going to make a movie about a rat that opens a restaurant, and or we're going to make a movie about the four feelings that live inside a little girl's head. Because I guarantee you the conventional wisdom in Hollywood is still that no boy will go to a movie that stars a girl, and that, you know, you can, or that girl-centric pictures don't do well. But when Pixar's like, you know, we are sitting on a throne of cash made from Toy Story movies, so we're going to make a movie about a girl and her feelings, and it will do just fine. They're like, oh, of course, that's just fine.
So you mentioned the Farallon Islands earlier.
I did.
Transitions from 15 minutes ago that we just blew right past.
Right.
That calls to mind a movie that's in theaters right now, Lisa.
Yeah.
Called The Shallows, which is fittingly starring Blake Lively.
The reason I'm laughing is because I'm like, that would actually be an excellent name for a celebrity-backed weekly lifestyle newsletter. Just call it The Shallows. Revel
Which Blake Lively would edit.
Well, she had Preserve.
Yeah, I know.
But I really feel like you should have some starlet who's in on the joke who launches The Shallows as like a weekly lifestyle letter. It's completely unrepentantly detached from reality. And, like, their whole pitch is, look, we know this is patently ridiculous, but, you know, you people will read anything, and here are some pictures of me drinking a ginger smoothie, so let's all just be complicit.
So, speaking of patently ridiculous, I would encourage everyone to go watch the trailer for The Shallows.
Yeah. Which, so the premise is that Blake Lively is a surfer who somehow gets attacked by a great white shark and then stranded on a rock. And then it's a game of shark and surfer, which is, I guess, the aquatic equivalent of cat and mouse, as she tries to avoid getting chomped before she can make it to the shore. So we are,
I guess... It's a battle of wits between a shark and Blake Lively. At last, Blake Lively finds herself on equal footing.
Well, let's go back to the premise that sharks have an alien intelligence that we can't quite comprehend. So, okay, sure, maybe it makes sense for this shark to be like, I can leave no witnesses because I ate those other two surfers. maybe that's shark logic. No loose ends, baby.
No loose ends.
Glub, glub, no loose ends. I love when I make you laugh like this.
When you reference my favorite Miami Vice episode, there is nothing else I can do. Yeah.
But the thing is that sharks, generally speaking, and any good ichthyologist will tell you this, like, fish are not going to waste a lot of time on a meal that got away, because they have other, they have calories to conserve. They have places to be.
To quote shark expert Richard Dreyfuss, they eat and
swim and make little baby and sharks.
Make little baby sharks, yes. Yeah.
So the idea of a grudge holding great white shark is kind of patently ridiculous, but I'm really intrigued by it.
Yeah. You got lucky. I'm just gonna wait. You gotta come into shore sometime.
Yeah. So you know, it's woman versus nature.
Yeah.
It's one of the great conflicts as outlined in Ars Poetica. I mean, we had Robert Redford versus the sea, and I'm gonna drown an old man, or whatever that movie was called. And
spoiler alert.
There was that horrifying movie about a decade ago about two people who get stranded after their scuba boat goes back into land.
And they basically tread water and become,
until they die.
And become shark bait, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, the whole man versus nature theme is rich and thematic, but this is just such a dumb example.
Well, yeah. And, I mean, when...
Yeah, and here's the thing is, I'm actually kind of a Blake Lively apologist. Like, I like her in the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants movies. I think she's sweet and sunny, and, you know, she's inoffensive, but, and good for her for being in a shark movie. So, yay, you go, girl.
I've always confused her with Lily Sobieski. Yeah.
Whereas Lily Sobieski, I'm like, did they do a Helen Hunt cloning experiment?
And in fact, the other day I had a dream where Helen Hunt and Lily Sobieski were trying to disguise themselves as one another.
Bizarrely, Helen Hunt is now an accomplished surfer who lives in Hawaii.
It all comes full circle.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. So, yeah,
what they should have done in this movie, it should have been Lily Sobieski and Blake Lively and Helen Hunt out for a surfing adventure.
Yes,
a girl's and then some sharks come along. Yeah, and exactly. Then it's the sharks versus the ladies.
Yeah. Not the sharks versus the jets.
No. Sharks. Although, given that the shark is so clearly a CGI shark.
It's, yeah, especially when there's a really hilarious moment in the preview where the shark leaps out of the water to eat a surfer. And it is like somebody watched one of those Air Jaws clips from Shark Week and was like, I can do that with my computer.
At last, someone has filmed my vision.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, they should do a CGI thing in the movie The Shallows where the shark starts snapping its fins. And
yeah. No, it's... Again, there's a lot of things about great white sharks that are innately fascinating, period. I urge anybody who's interested in sharks to read Susan Casey's book, The Devil's Teeth. Mm-hmm. You and I were lucky enough to actually see great white sharks when the Monterey Bay Aquarium was still displaying them occasionally.
Right.
And that remains one of the most chilling experiences I've ever had at an aquarium.
Mm-hmm. Why was it chilling, Lisa?
The Monterey Bay Aquarium has the deep sea.
Deep ocean.
Deep bay.
Deep bay, yes.
The idea is that it's because the Monterey Bay itself has a very wide, shallow bottom, and then it drops off suddenly to abyssal depths. And it's the variation in the depth of the bay that makes for such a rich ecosystem there. And they do have an outer bay exhibit, which is populated by denizens of the deep water and includes several mola molas, also known as sunfish. You may be familiar with them from the viral YouTube clip of the guy who was excited about the baby whale. Nah, kid, we got a baby whale here. So several mola mola. They sometimes have turtles.
Yeah. They dolphin fish.
They often have the dolphin fish, which look like the aliens from the Silent Earth.
yes.
And they'll have schools of bluefin tuna, which are stunning to watch because they are so fast and so slick. And occasionally they'll have like seven gill sharks or other, you know, tiny sharks. when they had the great white shark there, we went and walked up to the glass and we were just standing there. And all you saw was this big expanse of blue water, because all of the other fish seemed to be mysteriously missing. And all you saw was this expanse of blue water. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, we saw this white snout and teeth. Yeah. And
it just swims out of the darkness and right at you.
And I remember thinking, like...
And then you change your pants.
The gibbering monkey part of my brain was all dead, dead, dead. And then, like, the higher part of my brain was like, this is probably the last thing a lot of animals see. Mm-hmm. But then we backed up and we looked for a little bit. And the reason that the dynamics in the aquarium were off was were wherever the great white shark was swimming, at the exact opposite end of the aquarium, every other fish was clustered. Right. Like, literally none of them would go near the great white shark. And so it was almost like watching one of those models, those solar system models where you have, like, the sun and the earth kind of rotating. And they're very far away and always 180 degrees out. It was like that, except with a great white shark and about 40 other fish.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're terrifying.
No, it was a very interesting exhibit. The other thing I enjoyed about it was the film that they had where it's Peter Benchley saying, "I once wrote a book about a shark being a bloodthirsty monster, and boy, am I sorry about that.
I've regretted it every minute since."
Yeah, sharks aren't really trying to kill you, except for you, Blake Lively. That shark wants you dead.
Although, to be fair, the last shark that we saw, the last great white shark we saw at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, they had to release it when it went after one of the people feeding it.
Yeah.
Because it leapt out of the water at the person.
Yep.
I guess it was like, I am reducing the link between me and the food, so this is just me being, you know, GTD, getting
they
things
should
done.
Should not have hired Blake Lively for that internship. She really irritates the sharks. They read her website. They said, this is crap.
I prefer goop.
This consumer is crap.
Yeah.
This perpetuates the beauty myth.
Yeah, well. So yeah, it looks extravagantly dumb.
Yeah.
Even among the genre movies. I have no doubt, however, that the marketing tie-in campaign probably has get Blake Lively's deltoids or whatever. And
she wear a bikini throughout it, so there's that.
Yeah, exactly. And her skin looks great even after she's been ravaged by sharks and standing on coral for hours.
You know, really, judging by the clips we saw, the best thing you can do for your skin is to get bit by a shark.
Yeah.
Because the healing power of shark bites.
Well, she stuck the wound in salt water. That worked.
Oh.
Yeah.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. That was the... I think that was the dumbest... And I say this as a woman who watched a troll movie preview today. So there is that. All right, Phil, is there anything else you'd like to discuss?
I think we are getting to the portion of the program where we talk about things that we've seen.
Sure.
As opposed to just trailers, that we actually go and see movies.
Yeah.
So if you want to talk about Secret Life of Pets or anything you've seen.
Yeah, Secret Life of Pets is workmanlike. I'm not the core audience, but the 5-year-olds that were I was surrounded by and my own were laughing at all the jokes. So it was interesting to see every beat of the movie laid out. And I am now thinking all sorts of thoughts about how we teach people what a sense of humor is, because this movie seems like training wheels for humor.
Yeah.
We have been on a musicals binge lately.
Yes, we have.
Because we introduced our daughter to part of West Side Story. Only part, I hasten to add.
Yep.
And we introduced
the part before it turns bad for Maria and
everybody, really. We introduced her to the greatest musical number of all time, which is America, as performed by Rita Moreno. And I realize your greatest musical number is different, Phil. But,
yes.
But
the greatest musical number of all time is Shall We Dance from The King and I with Yul Brynner and
Deborah Carr.
Deborah Carr, thank you.
Yeah.
And number two would be Make Them Laugh from Singing in the Rain with Donald O'Connor.
I will defend the honor of America, the number. Rita Moreno's compelling. You can't take your eyes off her. So we saw that. You and I recently watched for like the umpteenth time. Every time this movie's on, we can't look away. Jesus Christ Superstar.
It is.
Ted Neely. Yeah. Every time it is on, you and I are like, oh, our plans to go to bed before midnight are foiled.
No, because we were going to just tape it on the DVR.
Yeah.
Or record it on the DVR.
Yeah.
There's no tape involved.
Yeah, we were just going to take up some space in the hard drive.
And watch it at our leisure. And then we started watching it. We're all, let's stay and watch forever.
Yeah. And next thing you know, the movie is over and we're like, what just happened? And Ted Neely had favorited your tweets.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, because we were live tweeting it for a while and Ted Neely... Mm-hmm. Ted Neely knows when you're tweeting about him. Let me just warn you.
That's a little creepy. Well, I've seen two filmed versions of Jesus Christ Superstar.
Right. The 1973 Norman Jewison film.
Yeah. And then I've seen the one that came out, and I want to say 99 or 2000, where they gave it a really 90s update to it.
It was 2000 because when my trips to New York for Macworld mm-hmm. Expo,
yeah.
back when there were Macworld Expos in mm-hmm. New York, it was a frightening time, children. that was actually live on Broadway.
Yeah.
That
revival. Yeah, because they have at the very end when they do the Jesus Christ Superstar, the chorus of angels is dressed like biker daddies except for chicks. And
yeah.
And the staging of I should put on, I love that musical.
Yeah,
it's good. I do love this musical, like weirdly and deeply, and there are tons of reasons to love it. And what has been fascinating to me is how each time it's been filmed, someone has tried to bring the aesthetics of the decade into the story, and they've still managed to completely miss the mark.
Yeah.
Because with the 2001, it has the feel of the Spice Girls would like to teach you a lesson. It does. It does.
And lo, Posh Spice looked upon the multitude and said, take these three fishes and don't eat them because fish is fattening.
And in the 1970s, I get what Norman Jewison was trying to do with the framing device around the movie and the aesthetic and all that. And
For people who have not seen the 1973 version, the framing device is
a bunch of hippies get off a bus and then turn into Jesus and the apostles. There's a bus that drives
out into the middle of the desert, and a bunch of hippies come out and frolic and put on a little show for all of us.
Literally. Like, they come out, they put on the costumes.
And then at the end, after Jesus has been crucified, the hippies get back on the bus and they're very sad.
Yeah. And perhaps it's supposed to be...
And Ted Neely, don't get on the bus, man.
And perhaps it's supposed to be a commentary on how the Gospels are actually a constructed narrative and highly performative in their own way, blah, blah, blah. Doesn't come through. It comes through as false profundity. But Jewison is totally fond of this, though, because you and I watched the end of Fiddler on the Roof.
Yes.
And he does the same thing where the fiddler literally follows Topol and family out of town.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh, so that is Norman Jewison's thing.
That was his thing.
But... we were looking at Jesus Christ Superstar, and the problem is Jesus.
Yeah. Sorry, Twitter buddy Ted Neely.
If the lightning bolt comes down and strikes me, know that I've always loved you. Mm-hmm. And part the thing is they always cast Jesus as like this gentle hippie who looks like he could, you know, make some kombucha and have strong opinions about tempeh. And like has really great conditioner on his hair because it never frizzes, but like that doesn't square with the idea that he's got a gang of 12 radicals that are going around preaching social disruption.
Mm-hmm.
Like in theory, the way they play Jesus, they play him as a drip, and you need a completely different characterization. And I have yet to see the one that I would accept in the movies.
There has never been a good portrayal of Jesus on film.
Yeah.
Not a one.
No, because it's always, again, Jesus seems half stoned and really into hair care.
You heard me, Jim Cazaville.
Whatever his name is.
Yeah, I don't even think enough of you to get your name right.
Jeremy Sisto played Jesus in like a made for TV movie.
He did, the NBC miniseries.
Mm-hmm.
Jeffrey Hunter in King of Kings.
Yeah.
Was it Max von Sydow in The Greatest Story Ever Told? I think I'm right in saying that.
Mm-hmm.
And Ben-Hur, of course, just wisely filmed Jesus from the back like he was the president in a 1930s movie.
No, really? Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
No, you need I would like to see a different interpretation, especially in the context of the musical, when the whole conflict between Jesus and Judas mm-hmm. is an ongoing dialogue about what it means to be a radical who wants to remake society. Like, Judas gets to be a firebrand and a radical, but what they forget is that the dynamic works precisely because he's playing off another radical and they're having an argument over executing strategy, basically.
Mm. Yeah.
So, you know, it doesn't work that way. And I also think that would make the song I Don't Know How to Love Him, I think that would actually make that song better than it is now, because right now it's Mary Magdalene who's, like, working herself up over her emo boyfriend with the great hair. Whereas if it's about a challenging, angry, revolutionary type of guy and she's singing the song, it would be a song about the challenge of loving somebody who, frankly, can be really a handful at times.
I would encourage the listening audience to track down the album Jesus Christ Surfer Star,
yeah.
which takes the musical and sets it to surf guitar.
Yeah. Although they cut out like two verses of I Don't Know How to Love Him on that, yeah. And that drives me bonkers.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
It's still good. Yeah. I want to tell the Josh Mostel story.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Josh Mostel plays...
Herod.
Yes.
He plays Herod. As Lisa mentioned, Norman mm-hmm. Jewison directed Fiddler on the Roof.
Yeah.
Instead of casting Zero Mostel,
mm-hmm.
who portrayed Tevye on Broadway, he cast Topol.
Mm-hmm.
Largely because Zero Mostel was very difficult to work with, mm-hmm. by all accounts. And so Josh Mostel gets cast, and he goes to tell his dad, Dad, Norman Jewison cast me in Jesus Christ Superstar. And Zero Mostel says, are you sure they didn't want to cast Topol's son?
So bitter.
I love that.
Yeah.
That is one of my favorite, mm-hmm. favorite bitter Hollywood stories ever.
Why?
You cannot top yeah. that.
So that was not the only musical. Like I said, we watched the end of Fiddler on the Roof,
uh-huh.
Which is just, that is just the breakdown of all musicals. I don't know why high school students do that musical, because
the actual musical itself yeah. is peppy and yeah. has its moments, whereas the film version of it is really
unrelentingly
capped and bring down. And
yeah.
We filmed it in the mud. Well, that's good.
Hooray, mud. Yeah.
Great.
But the one musical you and I wrestled, much like Jacob and the Angel,
uh-huh.
was the cinematic adaptation of Phantom of the Opera.
Oh, man.
With Emmy Rossum and Gerard Butler. Wait, I can do this. With Emmy Rossum and Gerard Butler.
Gerard Butler.
Yes, him.
He's the Phantom. And also Night Owl is Raoul.
Yes, Raoul.
But that's okay. Patrick Wilson, because he's a Broadway showman.
Yeah, he's,
whereas Emmy Rossum plays Christine Diet as if she is half baked.
Mentally challenged. Yeah, no, it's if you didn't know a single thing about this musical and you went into it, you would be like, why is that man with the mask running off with that poor vacant woman who seems to have suffered some sort of big trauma? And then what is poor? Can we talk about Patrick Wilson's career for a minute? Because he's made a lot of really bad movies.
He has.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's really talented. I hope this is what he does, because being on Broadway is an expensive habit.
Yeah.
But you and I watched Phantom of the Opera, and
we watched it recently, but yeah. I want to point out, we also watched it in the theater.
I know, and we barely made it through that time too.
Yeah.
But the thing that has always bugged me about this adaptation of
it. You actually shushed some high school students.
Because if I'm going to pay my $12, I want to hear what's going on in the movie. Mm-hmm. Even if Gerard Butler sing-talking his way through everything. Like, he literally...
Floating, falling, sweet intoxication!
It is literally like yeah. that. And
they should have cast Fred Schneider as the Phantom.
No one would have believed that he was into Christine. Like, literally no one. But the thing is
you will curse the day you did not do.
I like the idea
that the Phantom asks of you.
I like that, because then the ideas of the rest of the B-52s come bouncing out, like in Burrow
Cops. The Phantom is a little scary guy with a purple mask.
Candles Phantom.
Candles Phantom.
Because the candles yeah. budget for this movie.
Uh-huh.
But there's the genuinely hilarious sequence where the Phantom has basically smooth-talked Christine coming back to his lair.
Oh, yeah.
Which has, like, a swan bed, and he plays music at her, and mm-hmm. she's drifting around in her mentally vacant state, and she goes to take off his mask, and presumably this is when she sees how horribly disfigured she is. But it's Gerard Butler, a young Gerard Butler, and he has, like, a little scar at his temple.
Yeah, he has basically acne.
And it's just... That is where the movie was not really hanging together, as it were, but that was the point where I was like, you have got to be kidding me. You can't even make this hideous creature that lives in the swamp hideous. You have to make him just look, you know, like he's having a bad skin day.
See, I thought you were going to mention when they're swarming about the Phantom's lair.
And all these candles, lit candles come out of the water.
Yes, and Emmy Rossum comes across the mannequin of her that the Phantom has constructed.
And put a wedding dress on.
And put a wedding dress
and,
on.
And, like, her impulse is not to run away screaming, her impulse is to swoon.
Yes. And the Phantom looks at her like, I hope this isn't a deal breaker.
Yeah, and it's not. That's the thing, is it's not. Like, the deal breaker is he has a hissy fit over showing his blackheads, but yeah. it's the most Joel Schumacher movie ever made.
Yeah.
Like, you could literally put someone in a box for 11 years and get out and show them, like, the sequence of the masquerade ball and be like, oh, that's Joel Schumacher.
Yep, this and the nipples on the Batman suit, I think, are the two defining factors of Joel Schumacher's career.
Yeah. The only good thing about this movie is Minnie Driver's performance.
Yeah, she's quite good.
She's quite good in it. You know, Patrick Wilson sings and is... But they give him terrible hair, which is also an obstacle here. And he just is such a cipher on the screen compared to, well, everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just such an epically awful adaptation of, well, what is frankly a big showy...
You could have made a very good Phantom movie. Yeah. I'm not the world's biggest Phantom of the Opera fan.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's a great musical, but I think it is a musical that requires a degree of showmanship and non-contempt for the material. Because really, you get the sense that Joel Schumacher really didn't like the musical.
So the musical fascinates me on one level because Andrew Lloyd Webber wrote it for a woman who would later go on to leave him.
Yeah.
And there's like a whole lot of complicated backstory and weird stuff.
And Andrew Lloyd Webber also looks like a guy who lives in a lair.
Exactly. So you get the sense that he's working out a whole bunch of relationship issues. And so on that level, it's kind of fascinating. What's the relationship between the creator and the muse? And, you know, what obligation do you have to your talent? And like, literally none of that happens here. They tried to make it a grotesquerie almost. But, oh, God forbid you make Gerard Butler look grotesque, which... Just again, what it comes down to is oh, Christine, are you gonna choose between the bland guy who can the bland guy who I guess just likes you, or the really difficult temperamental boyfriend with a candle budget? Because this movie doesn't make a case for Raoul at all.
No,
and it basically is like, oh, the Phantom's kind of emo, you know, like he has an Nine Inch Nails sticker on the side of the piano, and you know, maybe experiment with eyeliner before he put on the mask, and it just. Ugh, it's just such a compellingly awful movie.
A misfire on every level.
Yeah.
Every creative decision is a poor one.
Yeah, I would love to have been in the screening room with the executives who watched that and then have gotten their candid reactions where they're like, well, this is a thing. You know? Or if they're like, this will be great because Joel Schumacher does epic naughty parties or whatever. Mm. So... But
epic naughty parties.
this movie should have sunk a lot of people's careers.
Yeah, and it didn't.
Yeah. Well, I'm told Emmy Rossum is quite good on Shameless.
Well, good for her.
Mm-hmm.
Good for her. I've never been able to.
Well, when we get around to filming some on Netflix, perhaps we'll tackle that.
Yeah. Okay. Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was it. So, any movies that you would like to talk about? In addition?
I'll do it briefly since we've dwelled a lot on musicals tonight. We have the only 5-year-old who has a crush on Errol Flynn.
Oh, God, I'm so glad he's dead.
So we are working our way through his back catalog. We just saw the Captain Blood.
Yeah.
Which is okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's not his best movie. There's not enough sword play in it for my taste.
Also, his hair looks terrible all the way through.
Yeah, yeah. It does.
And they have a weirdly light. Not weirdly. One of the things that always. Sits strange with me about movies that are made pre-1940 is the really ambivalent attitude that the writers and directors took towards the phenomena of slavery.
Yeah.
Where it was viewed as an inconvenience at best, but it's never thought of as like, it's some, basically Errol Flynn's attitude through the whole movie is, well, people like me shouldn't have to be slaves.
Yeah.
So it's not like a condemnation of the institution in any way, shape, or form. It's rather, well, it's terribly inconvenient if you're of the tone. Mm-hmm. And this also reminds me of us watching The Toy Wife, where, you know, you're supposed to root for the person who's shooting down
Yes.
People who are freeing slaves, or even Gone with the Wind, which is another one that is like, oh, I miss the days of child labor, you know, conscripted child labor. So that weirded me out a bit about this movie, where the whole attitude towards slavery was, well, it's inconvenient, but I'll escape without consequence. And I'm all, no, no, no. Oh, this is terrible.
Yeah, no. Of the Errol Flynn, Michael Curtiz collaboration pirate movies, the Seahawk is still the better of the
options. But yes, we have a 5-year-old who literally grins and ducks her head and scrapes her toe across the sidewalk if you mention Errol Flynn. It's unnerving.
Yeah.
We're not providing any details of his biography, mind you.
No,
as far as she's concerned, he's just a nice man who likes to play pirates a lot. So,
and Robin Hood.
Yeah,
although she didn't really care for Robin
Hood. No, she's into pirates.
Yeah, the pirate one. She we're gonna try and do Against All Flags next. That's Errol Flynn and Maureen O'Hara as a lady pirate.
Well, there you go. So. She's into lady pirates. That'll be good. Yep. So you've heard enough now about how we're ruining the minds of tomorrow and what we feel about musicals and Pixar sequels. Any closing thoughts, Phil?
I have none whatsoever.
All right. Let's go back to seeing what other terrible musicals will keep us up on a late night. This has been Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies with me, Lisa Schmeiser.
And me, Philip Michaels.
Please also check out the Incomparables homepage, because you'll see a link there to sponsoring the Incomparable, having a membership, which will give you all sorts of privileges, like, telling us what terrible movies we should watch and react to.
Membership numbers are a little light this month. And Mickey doesn't want to have to get rough with y'all.
We'd also encourage you to look for the Facebook community, because we do talk to folks there, too. Thanks again for listening.